Welcome to God and Country Radio, a program that discusses social, political, economic, and prophetic events in the light of biblical theology. I'm your host, Pastor Brad Winship, pastor of Harbor Bible Church in Central New Jersey. This week's program is session number 10 in a series called The Biblical Doctrines of Civil Government. And the topic for this week is the law. Civil magistrates, civil authorities are to be ministers of God, an avenger who brings wrath on the one who practices evil. But evil needs to be defined, and what wrath and judgment should be applied. Are judges and legislators left up to their own devices, or is there some word from God on this issue? The debating of law is what political discussion is all about. And in this, we must consider that natural man is by nature lawless. You know, not only the criminal, but the civic leaders who make the law. They too fail to enact justice because of their own lawlessness. So as the prophet Isaiah writes in Isaiah 59, justice is turned back, and righteousness stands far away, for truth has stumbled in the streets, and uprightness cannot enter. Isaiah 5, those who justify the wicked for a bribe, and take away the rights of the one who are in the right. And Isaiah chapter 10, verse 1, woe to those who enact evil statutes, and those who constantly record unjust decisions. The evil of civil authorities, who do not rule according to the law of God, is addressed throughout the scripture. Even as Jesus spoke about the unjust judge, who didn't fear God or respect man, or the Pharisees, who transgressed the commandments of God for the sake of their traditions. Lawless magistrates, rather than being an avenger to bring wrath on the one who works evil, becomes avengers bringing wrath on the ones who do righteousness. So that Isaiah 59:15, the one who does right makes himself the prey of evil rulers. The French philosopher, political philosopher, Friedrich Bastiat, explained in his famous work, The Law, that unprincipled rulers will pervert the law and turn it into legal plunder. The law is used to deprive one group of citizens their rights for the benefit of an evil group of citizens. And rather than the law being guided by the higher principles of divine justice, the law is guided by political brute force for the benefit of the ruling class and their constituency. The 20th century Christian philosopher Francis Schaeffer continually pointed out that since communism is anti-God and anti-God's natural law, law in communist countries, even in Western secular democracies, becomes arbitrary. It's whatever the civil rulers believe is utilitarian. The ends justify the means. And the foundation for our morals becomes whatever benefits the state. Well, then on top of all this, there is an eschatological dimension to the law, the lawlessness of the last days. In the Olivet Discourse, Jesus said lawlessness will increase. And the Antichrist is called the man of lawlessness. Not that he won't have laws, but whatever laws do not reflect God's holiness are not true laws. Daniel 7:25, the prophesied Antichrist, this world ruler will make alterations in times and laws. So expect that in the final days of this age, in the great rebellion prophesied in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, the state will disregard and pervert the law. No jail, no bail. The inmates will run the asylum because of a disbelief in sin and a disbelief in the justice of punishment. Romans chapter 8, the mindset on the flesh is hostile toward God. It doesn't subject itself to the law of God. The more godless a nation, the more lawless. Now, ultimately, God is the source of all law, and he reveals his law to mankind in two ways, natural revelation and written revelation. Natural revelation is what is written on the conscience of every man. Like birds know how to fly south in the winter, every man knows the Ten Commandments even before the Ten Commandments were given at Mount Sinai. And the Apostle Paul affirms the truth of natural revelation in Romans chapter 2, verse 14, "For when the Gentiles who do not have the law do instinctively the things of the law, these not having the law are law to themselves, in that they show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience bearing witness, and their thoughts alternatively accusing or else defending them." People have a conscience. Now, there are those who argue against natural revelation, saying nature is cruel. There's no written law of God on every blade of grass and on the stars in the sky, and that people's conscience differ. But nevertheless, the scripture teaches that despite people having seared their conscience and hardened their heart, there is the natural revelation of conscience. But to confirm and to reinforce natural law, which men try to suppress, God has given us written revelation, so that if our consciences become confused, we can always turn to the scriptures for clarification. Now, the law of God doesn't begin with the Ten Commandments given on Mount Sinai. It begins in Genesis, where God laid down moral patterns and examples. After the creation of Adam and Eve, Genesis chapter 2, verse 24, "For this cause a man shall leave his father and his mother and shall cleave to his wife, and they shall become one flesh." So in Genesis, we have the establishment of the institution of family and gender, the prohibition against adultery, polygamy, homosexuality, gender fluidity, all of which secularists are trying to overthrow as if these are just human constructs made up by man, by the powerful to oppress the weak. God expects all mankind to abide by the pattern he has established at the beginning. Even Jesus said to the people in his day, "Have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female?" There is moral law in Genesis. And notice that these regulations are not just for the church, but for all the descendants of Adam and Eve, all humanity. Now, some claim that the state should get out of the marriage business, the marriage licensing business, but that's not the historic Christian position. The state is obligated to enforce God's natural law upon everyone, Christian or non-Christian. Now, after the Noahic flood, God made a new covenant with all mankind, a new command. Genesis chapter 9, verse 5, "Surely I will require your lifeblood. From every beast I will require it, and from every man, from every man's brother, I will require the life of man. Whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed, for in the image of God he made man." So here we have the law of capital punishment, part of the Noahic covenant, which is quite emphatic. And this covenant has never been abrogated or set aside, even as Paul argues in Galatians chapter 3, that even the Mosaic law that came 430 years after the promise to Abraham doesn't nullify the previous covenant God made with Abraham. It's quite peculiar that some religious people oppose capital punishment, since it's one of the clearest and most defined requirements of God. And to not practice capital punishment and to preserve the life of the murderer is to curse the nation with blood guilt. Numbers 35:33. "So you shall not pollute the land in which you are, for blood pollutes the land, and so no expiation can be made for the land, for the blood that is shed on it, except by the blood of him who shed it." In Isaiah chapters 24 through 26, there is the apocalypse of Isaiah, the first full prophecy of the coming apocalypse, which is described again later in the book of the Revelation. Isaiah 24, "The earth is also polluted by its inhabitants, for they transgressed laws, violated statutes, broke the everlasting covenant. Therefore a curse devours the earth, and those who live in it are held guilty. Therefore the inhabitants of the earth are burned, and few men are left." The pollution that calls for the judgment of God is not CO2, but moral guilt for violating God's law. And notice it's the whole world that's guilty, not just Israel. The eternal covenant mentioned in Isaiah 24 that has been violated is most likely the Noahic covenant requiring capital punishment for blood guilt. Because in Genesis chapter 9, the Noahic covenant is actually called the everlasting covenant. And Isaiah goes on to prophesy in this text that the coming apocalypse is about unrequited blood guilt. Isaiah 26:21, "For behold, the Lord is about to come out of his place to punish the inhabitants of the earth for their iniquity, and the earth will reveal her bloodshed and will no longer cover her slain." Throughout the Bible, unpaid for blood guilt always brings the wrath of God down upon a people. Hosea chapter 1, "I will punish the house of Jehu for the bloodshed of Jezreel." Deuteronomy 19:13, "You shall not pity the murderer, but you shall purge the blood from the innocent from Israel, that it may go well for you." And as we go to the book of the Revelation, one of the major themes is that the world is being punished for unpaid blood guilt. Revelation 6:10, "How long, O Lord, true and holy, will you refrain from judging and avenging our blood on those who dwell on the earth?" Revelation 18:24, "And in her were found the blood of the prophets and the saints and of all those who have been slain upon the earth." And Revelation 16:6, "For they poured out the blood of the saints and the prophets. You have given them blood to drink. They deserve it." And when the prophet Joel prophesies about the apocalypse and Armageddon, Joel chapter 3, verse 21, God says, "I will avenge your blood, which I have not avenged." So in the last days, not just in the Old Testament, but in the New Testament age, God still requires the lifeblood of murderers. And unpaid for blood guilt brings judgment on the land. Now, objections to capital punishment range from claims of compassion, or as the ACLU claims, it's cruel and unusual punishment. But these claims ignore the justice that's due the victim. I mean, regardless of whether capital punishment is a deterrent or not. And since earthly judges can have no adequate recompense or compensation for murder, the murderer is sent to stand before the judgment bar of God, and that is compassion. I sense that much of the objection to capital punishment and many other penalties for crime is really coming out of a heart that subconsciously despises God's evaluation of sin. Psalm 50 sums it up. "Concerning the wicked, you hate discipline. You cast my words behind you. When you see a thief, you're pleased with him, and you associate with adulterers." Well, the subject of capital punishment is quite extensive, but one more point to bear in mind is that under the law of Moses, there was capital punishment for crimes that weren't directly the shedding of blood. Rape, kidnapping, striking certain people, armed robbery. And the principle is that holding someone against their will is denying them life and threatening their life. Even the crime of selling illegal drugs could fall under the penalty of capital punishment. The drug pusher is selling death. Notice also that in the law of Moses, we see that there was little allowance for prison. The criminal cases were either crimes where the criminal could compensate the victim for their loss in some sort of work release parole, or the crime would involve capital punishment. So there is very little need for sending people to jail. A truly Christian legal system wouldn't stress the sedentary, unproductive institution of prison. Now, in regard to the law, civil rulers must legislate according to God's natural law, the law and conscience, and delineated in Scripture. But the big question that always comes up is, what about the law given to national Israel? The Old Covenant, the law of Moses, requiring capital punishment for adultery, witchcraft, homosexuality, requiring a double payback for theft, and the canceling of all debts and indentured servanthood at the end of 7 years. There is a movement called Reconstructionism, Dominionism, Theonomy, that teaches that Gentile nations must keep the Mosaic Law. And once the nations become obedient to the Mosaic Law, then the nations will be blessed and Christ's kingdom will come. And this movement is totally opposed to the concept of natural law, calling it nonsense. For how can people know the requirements of God's law without God's revealed Old Testament case law? And God's law is God's law. Why would God have any nation do anything different than the requirements he laid down for Israel? Well, to fully cover this subject and all of its pros and cons could take an entire semester. First, just be aware that the historic reform position has been that the Gentile nations must rule according to God's moral law, but not specifically in accordance with the prescribed case laws given to the Jews. The Westminster Confession of Faith, chapter 19, section 4, states, "To them also, to national Israel, as a body politic, God gave sundry judicial laws which expire together with the state of that people, not obligating any other now further than the general equity thereof may require." This was also taught by the early church fathers, and one example of many reformers is John Calvin, who explained this issue in his Treatise on Civil Government, sections 14 through 16. He points out that some espouse the error that the law of Moses is to be the common law for the nations. But Calvin explains the historic position is that both the ceremonial law and the judicial case laws were specifically given only to Israel. This was a temporary covenant for the Jews until Christ came, Galatians chapter 3. Hebrews chapter 9, verse 13, God made the first covenant obsolete. Whatever is growing old is ready to disappear. Also consider the Jerusalem Council, where the apostles did not support the position that the law of Moses was obligatory on the Gentiles. And even if we go into the Old Testament, the oracles against the other nations, the foreign nations surrounding Israel were never judged for not keeping the specifics of the Mosaic Code, as was Israel, but for violating the general moral law of God on the conscience and given in Genesis. Calvin writes, "But if it's true that each nation has been left at liberty to enact the laws which it judges to be beneficial, still these are always to be tested by the rule of charity, so that while they may vary in form, they must proceed on the same principle." Then Calvin goes on to explain that he's not promoting lawlessness, that every man can do what's right in his own eyes, but that the rule of charity is a very high standard in God's moral law. Calvin writes, "Those barbarous and savage laws, for instance, which confer honor on thieves, allow promiscuous intercourse between the sexes, and other things even fouler and more absurd, I do not think entitled to be considered law, since they're not only altogether abhorrent to justice, but also to humanity and civilized life." So Calvin, like all the reformers, believed that there ought to be laws against sexual immorality, as listed in Leviticus 18. The same sins mentioned in the Old Testament are also mentioned and condemned in the New Testament. But the nations are not to follow the same prescribed punishment for those sins as in Old Testament case law. Now, critics often try to discredit the use of the Bible in public policy because Old Testament law requires the death penalty for adultery or witchcraft or false teaching. But that's a misrepresentation of Christian truth. New Testament clearly teaches that the Mosaic Law was only for Israel and temporary. Now today, Gentile nations can and should have penalties for certain unfaithfulness in marriage, for sexual deviance, even laws against teaching false ideology. In Germany, it's illegal to teach Nazism. As is often said, the U.S. Constitution is not a suicide pact. People don't have the freedom to teach insurrection. So false teachers can be punished in a Gentile nation. It can be illegal to teach public school students sexual perversion. That's a prohibition against false teachers. But the penalty for such crimes is no longer to be capital punishment, The Gentile nations are to be under the everlasting covenant of Genesis chapter 11, that only the unjust shedding of blood requires the death penalty. Now, Calvin goes on in section 16 to explain how this works in practice. This is lengthy, but hang in there. Now, as it's evident that the law of God, which we call moral, is nothing else than the testimony of natural law, and of that conscience which God has engraved on the minds of men, the whole of this equity of which we now speak is prescribed in it. Hence, it alone ought to be the aim and the rule and the end of all law. Whenever laws are formed after this rule, directed to this aim and restricted to this end, there's no reason why they should be disproved by us, however much they may differ from the Jewish law and from each other. The law of God forbids to steal. The punishment appointed for theft in the civil polity of the Jews may be seen in Exodus 22. Very ancient laws of other nations punished theft by exacting double of what was stolen. Other laws went to the length of punishing with exile or with branding. All laws alike avenge murder with blood, but the kinds of death are different. In some countries, adultery is punished more severely, in others more lenient. Yet we see that amidst the diversity, they all tend to the same end. For they all with one mouth declare against those crimes which are condemned by the eternal law of God. Murder, theft, adultery, and false witness, though they agree not as to the mode of punishment. This is not necessary nor even expedient. I mean, there may be a country which, if murder was not visited with fearful punishment, would instantly become prey to robbery and slaughter. There may be an age requiring that the severity of punishment should be increased if the state is in a troubled condition. So don't be offended at this diversity. The Lord did not deliver it, the Old Testament law, by the hand of Moses to be promulgated in all countries and to be everywhere enforced. But having taken the Jewish nation under special care, patronage, and guardianship, he was pleased to be specially its legislator. And as became a wise legislator, he had special regard to it in enacting laws. Unquote. John Calvin. Few closing thoughts. Even though the Mosaic law is not in force, nations can still learn from the general moral principles in Old Testament case law. When you build a house, you need a railing so people don't fall off a high place. And there should be some limitations on how much debt can be put upon other people. All of these principles were taught in English common law and in Blackstone commentaries. The nations do need to turn back to God and return to the scripture and do a much better job in administrating true justice and law. Yes, a nation under God will argue which penalties for which crime, but we'd rather live in a country that debates the application of biblical principles than in a country that operates on the foundation of secular moral license. You probably heard the slogan, "You can't legislate morality." That has to be one of the most foolish and wicked statements anyone could ever make. Because all law legislates morality. And it's the sole duty of legislators to legislate morality. Isaiah chapter 10, verse 1, "Woe to those who enact evil statutes and those who constantly record unjust decisions." You've been listening to God and Country Radio. This has been Session 10 in the Doctrines of Civil Government. The website to listen to this program again or other past programs is godandcountryradio.org. Just spell it out, godandcountryradio.org. From there, you can correspond. The YouTube and Rumble video versions of this program is at the channel God and Country Biblical Exposition. Thank you for listening. Thank you for your support. Joy to the world. The Lord has come. Let earth receive her King.